We're going to be talking about religions in the New Testament world tonight. So very glad that you can be part of our study. Les, would you open us with prayer, please?
Dear Lord, we are so grateful for the beautiful day that we've had, for the things that we've been able to do today. Thankful for the soundness of mind and heart and spirit as we enter this assembly and study together. We're thankful that we know the creator of the universe and know the truth and can be able to compare that with the idol-worshiping religions of the world and be able to see so clearly the differences. And thank you for Philip and Lori, and thank you for the other classes that are here, and pray that your blessings would be on them as they teach. In Jesus' name we pray.
Okay. Amen. So look very quickly to Luke 22. This is like a additional insert to today's lesson. Luke 22 was our reading today, congregational reading. And I want you to look at verse 2 of Luke 22 and see if the recent study has provided a little insight. And hopefully these kinds of statements will jump out at you. Luke 22, verse 2 says, "And the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to put him to death, for they feared the people." Jesus was popular, so the chief priests and the scribes were looking for a way to do Jesus in. Now, that should jump out at you. The chief priests were leaders of what party or sect? Sadducees, close. Sadducees. They were the more elite. They were smaller in number. They were connected to the aristocracy. And they ran the temple complex, the chief priests. And they got a cut from all that economic activity there. The scribes, most scribes, not all, most scribes were connected to what party? The Pharisees. And the scribes were sort of the leaders of the Pharisees. How did the Sadducees and Pharisees typically get along?
Not well.
But on this occasion, what are they doing?
Conspiring.
They're conspiring together to do Jesus in. So in the first century, among anybody who knew Jewish society, if you said the chief priests and scribes are working together on something, it would be like, you know, Joe Biden and Kevin McCarthy are working together on something? I mean, it'd be something like that, you know, Republicans and Democrats. It would be like, what? But that's what's happening here. I want you to think about, we're going to talk about the Gentile world and their religions in the first century. But we spent quite a bit of time looking at the Jewish history between Old and New Testament and the Jewish religion by the time you get to the New Testament. And I would have you to remember this one thing about the Jewish situation, not just the scribes and Pharisees, but also the other groups we talked about, like the Zealots and the Essenes. The Jewish religious situation was diverse to the point that it was complex in a way, even convoluted. However, and this is who Jesus came looking for, there was a sincere remnant of Jewish people living in the first century. Do you think of anybody that would probably fall in that category, a sincere Jewish person? Okay, Paul said he was sincere, even though he was a Pharisee. He thought he was doing the right thing. Yeah, and even before Paul, who would you think of?
Zacharias,
Elizabeth. Mary and Joseph, the first Jewish characters we're introduced to in the New Testament, are very righteous people, very sincere people. And of course, I think you can put the apostles in that category for the most part. And so it's a very convoluted situation. If you said someone's a Jew, that can mean a lot of different things religiously at this point. But it's nothing compared to the diversity and complexity of the pagan world. So that's what I want us to look at now by, first of all, starting with Matthew 28, 19 to 20. Matthew 28, 19 to 20. Rachel Messer, could you read those two verses for us, please? Matthew 28, those last two verses.
Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age.
All right, thank you. So the apostles were sent to all these Pharisees, Sadducees, Zealots, Essenes. They're just going to go to the Jews, right? Where are they going? All nations. Which means they're going to encounter all kinds of different cultures and religions. But their task is to do what with these people? Make them into what? Disciples. And recently in our study about Jesus as a teacher, disciple means what? Learner, follower, one who sits at the feet and learns from the teaching of another. And then he says in verse 20, teach them all that I've commanded you. They've got to take the gospel, they've got to take the teachings of Christ, and they've got to take it to the Greeks, the Romans, and all these people who lived in this first century world whose lives were dominated by this pagan culture. When you hear the term paganism, what do you think of? What pops into your head? Paganism.
Idolatry.
Idolatry. What else?
Idolatry.
Yeah. And what else?
Idolatry.
All the idol worship, temples, all that kind of thing. What else? I mean, the fact that they're worshiping idols means they believe in what? Multiple gods. Exactly right. So the first century world was pagan. So was the Old Testament world. But definitely the first century world was pagan. And let's get a little insight into that pagan world through three passages, okay? So everybody here to my left, down to the Smiths, I would like for you to look at Acts 17. And I want you to just read it to yourself, 22 to 30. Everybody on my right, from the Hamiltons back all the way to the end to Andrew, would you look at Acts 19, 21 to 36? Everybody behind the Smiths, Coney's and behind, and to the side of them, would you look at Romans 1, 18 to 32? So everybody take your text and read it. I just would like for you to call out some characteristics that you see of paganism in the first century. Acts 17 is Paul's message at the Areopagus or Mars Hill to the Athenian philosophers. What are some characteristics, real quickly, those who looked at that text?
Altar to the unknown God.
They had so many gods, they made sure they covered their bases by having an altar to an unknown god. And by the way, one has not been found in Athens, but they've uncovered those kind of altars in other places. So it was not uncommon for some community to put up an altar. Well, we might be missing one, so we'll put one up to him too. Don't want him to leave him out. Or her. What else do you see in Acts 17? What are the characteristics? Okay, temples, idols made with hands. Their gods were made out of what? Silver, gold, those kinds of things. All right, how about Acts 19? And this is the incident with the worshipers of Artemis in Ephesus getting upset with Paul. So what characteristics do you see there in Acts 19 about paganism?
There's profitable business in it.
There was money in it. There was big money in it. Yes, we saw that in the Corinthian study. What else? Especially in these cities that had the big temples. People came there. It's like going down to Charlotte and watching a Hornets game or a Panthers game or something. Really, a lot of similarities. What else do you see from Acts 19 about paganism? Okay, there's some kind of story that was floating around that something had descended from the sky. Yes, and landed there to bless Ephesus. How intently did they believe in this idol, this god?
They're intense enough that they're getting the whole city in an uproar.
They've got the whole city in uproar, ready to try to do Paul in. That's exactly right. So this is a very intense thing. This is not something light among them. All right, Romans chapter 1, classic text about the pagan world, especially the first century world. What characteristics do you see about paganism in that text, Romans 1, 18-32?
Exchange the glory of the immortal God for images of man and animals.
I want you to watch that definition and a quote I'm going to show you on the next slide. They'd exchange God for all these false gods. They exchange the true God and the knowledge of the true God for all these false gods. And according to this text, the false gods that represented and looked like what? Things like what? Themselves, as well as animals, okay, creatures, as well as human beings. And according to Romans 1, what effect did paganism have on their moral behavior?
Homosexuality was mentioned.
But it corrupted their morals, including the extremity of homosexuality, females and males, both. So that gives you a sample. See, these Christians are facing that world. When they went to all nations preaching the gospel and making disciples, these are the people they encountered. This was, we look at idol worship and we think it's quaint silliness. Matter of fact, the average modern person who's not religious looks at idolatry as quaint silliness. Certainly we do, being Bible believers. But most people didn't think that then. And actually, the intellectuals and the elites, they believed in this just like the others. Now, some more than others and so forth, but there's some variety here. But this was the reality they were facing. And it was a formidable, do you see this in this text, these texts? This was a formidable reality they're having to take the gospel to. So, what do we know about this world? So, we're going to talk about it here. So, here we go. I'll probably recommend these two books at the end of the class, and this is one of them. It's an oldie but a goodie, Merrill Tenney's New Testament Times. Such good prose. He's so easy to read and understand. Cuts right to the chase. This is his introduction about paganism. He says, paganism is the human attempt to satisfy an inner longing for God by the worship of a deity which will not obstruct one's desire for self-satisfaction. He's describing the ancient world, but I want you to think about 2023 a little bit. Paganism is a parody and a perversion of God's original revelation to man. Well, that's Romans 1, isn't it? And watch this. This is where he really gets eloquent. It retains many basic elements of truth, but twists them into practical falsehood. Divine sovereignty becomes fatalism. Grace becomes indulgence. Righteousness becomes conformity to arbitrary rules. Worship becomes empty ritual. Prayer becomes selfish begging. The supernatural degenerates into superstition. The light of God is clouded by fanciful legend and by downright falsehood. And the consequent confusion of beliefs and of values left men wandering in a maze of uncertainty. When I came across that quote, I had to share that with you. That's a goodie. And yes, it's a formidable world of confusion and falsehoods and perversions that they're bringing the gospel to, but they're encountering people who are lost and empty because of it. And the gospel could save them. So, as dark as it looks, it just makes the light shine brighter. And just think of our world. And I want you to know, as I go through the different aspects of paganism in the first century tonight, I want you to think about the old adage, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And though, as Twain says, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. So look at the rhyming here. Okay, first of all, and boy, this is like describing Christianity in 5 minutes. This is so general that it's just, you know, you wonder if it's worth the while. But it is worth the while because Romans 1 does the same thing. Romans 1 basically just summarizes very briefly all of paganism. So I want you to think about what we would call the traditional Greco-Roman religions. Religion, I'll just put religion that way. And it's all about the many gods. Let's start with the Greeks. First of all, the pantheon of Greek gods were developed from early days. As soon as you find some of the early Greek writings are talking about the gods. But there is no document trail. We just are so blessed with the Bible. It is such a great collection of records. Other religions don't have that. And the Greek mythology, and what a great word for it, it is so mythological because they really don't have documentary evidence to the origins of these things. All of a sudden, Homer just starts writing about these things as if everybody knew about it. So you see these from early Greek days among those who lived in Greece, and Greek meaning very general, it's like saying European, these people were very diverse, and their colonies over in Asia Minor or Turkey today and over toward Italy. Same thing. We see these idols in those places. It's just part of their fabric of their existence. And I'm going to keep hammering this point. Morality was not typically connected to pagan idolatry. Zeus did not teach you, Poseidon didn't teach you how to become a better person. They didn't do that. Same with the Greeks and the Romans. So I'm going to keep hammering that. But what the belief in gods did, it was like a cultural marker. Belief in the gods created a sense of community as well as personal comfort. This is the one thing that ancient people got right. And that is, there is more than what meets the eye. There are forces beyond the physical. There is good and evil. There is something beyond the material world. And so idolatry was a way that they were trying to come up with explanations as to why things are the way they are and explain it. And humans have always tried to do that. Matter of fact, that's what religion is. Very simple definition of religion is the belief in that which is beyond human to explain what's going on with humans. That's a really good definition of religion. The gods were anthropomorphic. In other words, they acted like petty humans a lot. Angry humans, jealous humans, lustful humans, deceitful humans. Their character and behavior is very human-like. They had powers that humans didn't have. They could do things that humans couldn't do. But a lot of the really bad stuff about humans, you see it in these gods. A lot of elaborate rituals associated with idol worship, especially animal sacrifice, very common, grain sacrifices, drink offerings, all those kinds of things. And it was believed that you had to do this to please the god, to gain the god's favor. They would go through these rituals before they fought a battle. They would invade a country and pray to certain gods and so forth. They're trying to get the gods on their side for earthly advantage. Now, we're calling this Greco-Roman religion. We've noted how the Greeks and the Romans are very different, but by the time you get to the first century, they're living in a Greco-Roman world, a world shaped by, as we've noted, Greek culture, but also Roman ways, especially their government, their military, their rule, all those kinds of things. Well, the Romans also, before they begin to expand, they have a lot of traditional religion associated with gods, and it really mirrors even as it looks as if they borrowed from the Greeks. And we noted how that the Greeks colonized over in southern Italy and in Sicily. So the Roman culture was greatly influenced by the Greek culture. Some people say, and I'm not really great with my mythology as some people are, but like, you know, Zeus and Jupiter, right? That's right. Zeus is the chief god among the Greeks, and the equivalent would be Jupiter among the Romans. Ares and Mars is another correlation. They're not identical, but they look alike. There's a reflection there that's similar. So it's not like simply the Romans just took the Greek gods, but rather their gods tended to resemble the Greek gods. That's really a better way to put it. Not that they just lifted them, but they tended to be shaped by them, their understanding of them. So well into the Republic years, where Rome is ruled by the Senate and the upper class, and they occasionally have, early on they had some kings, and they occasionally have these temporary rulers that deliver them from oppression, but they're ruled by the Senate. And certainly during the empire phase, starting with Augustus all the way through the days of Jesus and all the way to the end of the Roman period, the religion was a means of creating unity among the Romans, especially support for the Roman state. It's like this, the Greeks used religion to bind the Greek people together. The Romans used religion to bind the people to the state. When they would have a setback in their military campaigns, they would say, oh, we need to have more sacrifices to the traditional gods. Matter of fact, when Augustus comes along, Octavian, who becomes Augustus, right before the birth of Jesus, he sort of, you know, revives the Romans there and he sets them on the path of empire. One of the things he does is that he revitalizes a lot of the traditional Roman religions, and he builds some new temples and hires more priests and more Vestal virgins. Yes, he does that to perform more sacrifices because we want to get those gods on our sides. That's what made us great, and we can't forget them, which is one of the reasons why, like by the third century, the Romans are, some of the Roman leaders are against Christians because they feel like too many people in the Roman Empire are Christians and they've neglected the traditional Roman gods, and Rome's becoming weak because of it. This would be the case in the early, late 3rd and early 4th century. Yeah, Andrew?
Throughout the Old Testament, you see, even from Genesis onward, you see each community, the Hittite gods, the Canaanite gods, the Amorite gods, Moabite gods, everybody's got their own set of gods. But once you turn the pages of the New Testament, everything you see is either Zeus, Apollo, or some variation. Do you think this is why?
That's a really good observation, that the gods tend to be extremely regional in the Old Testament. In the first century, you're seeing Roman Empire-wide gods. And I'm going to come to that in a moment. The Romans cherry-picked some of the gods from other regions they conquered and brought them actually to Rome. And so the Romans broadened the deities. They're not as regional in the Roman Empire. And it's sort of like, it's paganism in the Old Testament, but it's another level of paganism that's in even bigger and broader in the first century. Yeah, good observation. Okay, got that? So this is very interesting where they put Poseidon's temple. You know, Greece is a peninsula that sticks out into the Mediterranean Sea. That's at the very point of the Greek peninsula. And there's sea on three sides of that point. It's a good place for Poseidon, right? Makes sense. A couple more things about the traditional Greco-Roman religion in general. They're non-exclusive. And there tends to be a little bit of this in the Old Testament, back to Andrew's point. People tend to be interested in the various gods. You see, that's why Cyrus has the Jews to go back and rebuild their temple. He wants their God on his side. You know, Cyrus let other groups go back and build their temples too. Cyrus was covering all his bases. And you really see this with the Greeks and the Romans, especially the Romans. They never met a God they didn't like, so to speak. Non-exclusive. Oh, you got a God? Tell me about that God. Well, I think I'll go into that temple and drop a couple of, you know, drachma and go through a ritual and light a candle and maybe, you know, sacrifice a goat. And maybe that'll help me on my journey or something. This is another term that is so synonymous with paganism. It's syncretic. In other words, they borrow and blend. They learn from each other, and they incorporate one another's beliefs and practices into their religion. Matter of fact, I would have you see this and try this as a theory. Over time, every religion becomes syncretic. In other words, over time, religions tend to look around at other people and borrow and incorporate what they're doing. That's exactly what the Catholic Church did for about 1,000 years. They borrowed a little bit from the Jews, Greco-Roman paganism, and New Testament Christianity. That's Roman Catholicism. Yeah, Rick?
Druids,
okay, in the British Isles, okay. But they, the Romans really did this. They're trendsetters in that. These religions tend to be corporate religions. The traditional Greco-Roman religions, like worshiping Jupiter and worshiping, you know, Neptune and all that, and Artemis and Eros and so forth, it tended to be group corporate worship. The power was in the group, not about a personal search. And we're going to come to that in just a moment, because some people didn't like that and they were hungry for something more personal. And so that's why the festivities, the celebrations, the holy days, the games. Remember when we're studying about Corinth, it was near the games, and the games were connected to idolatry. They were connected to pagan worship and celebrations. And so, you know, you're having a drunken big time and wrapping your religion around it. And so it's a corporate kind of religion. Again, I want to hammer this point, morality not closely associated with them. You didn't go and worship at a temple to grow as an individual. You didn't worship an idol so that you became a better father or husband or mother or neighbor. You did it to get the God on your side to get something. You did it so the God wouldn't be angry with you and strike you or bring some calamity to your family. So morality is not part of the motivation. So just think about that. When Jesus came teaching what he taught, first of all, look how that Judaism was very different and how Judaism taught so much morality. Look at the Ten Commandments. And then Christ comes along, and then you have the teachings of the apostles. And, you know, the first thing Jesus says and John the Baptist says and the apostles say is repent. That's the first thing they say. So look how that's in contrast to pagan idolatry. Paganism didn't say, oh, you need to turn your life around and live a different life. That was not really the pull and the appeal. Okay. Now, as I said, these are the traditional Greco-Roman religions. So guess what happens? People get tired of traditional things. They get tired of the establishment. And so they're looking for something different. Couple things here. First of all, what is called the mystery religions. You really see these ramping up right before the New Testament, during the New Testament, even into the second and third centuries. And we know a lot about these from the early church writers. Some hints of these in the New Testament, but the early church writers writing in the early second century and late second century refer to these. Matter of fact, some of these belief systems, we only know about them because of what some of the early writers are saying who are part of the early church, late first century, early second century, etc. So what are we talking about here? Well, traditional religions left many individuals empty. They said, I'm tired of going to that temple and worshiping that same idol that my ancestors did and their ancestors and their ancestors. And they searched for something more. Doesn't that happen in every society? The people come along and they tire of the traditional religion and they want something different. That happens over and over and over. And of course, the point should not be, I want what's traditional or I want what's new. The point should be, I want what is true. Whether it's old, new, or what. It's a different pursuit, isn't it? So these are religions. They were very small, and they were associated with temples and idols too. They had certain deities they believed in. But these were new around the first century. They were unique, and they promised more personal fulfillment. Instead of bringing power to the Romans or bringing prosperity to the Greeks, or like in the case of, let's say, the Canaanites in the Old Testament, bringing prosperity and fertility to the agrarian life of the Canaanites, like, you know, Baal would do in Asheroth. It was about personally being fulfilled, personally being changed and delivered. As the Roman Empire went east and they got into Asia Minor, and they got down into Palestine and Egypt, and they got into what we call Mesopotamia, what we would call Iraq and Iran today. These mystery religions began to creep into the Roman Empire, and their influences took hold, not to the majority, but these regional kind of local religions in places like Mesopotamia. For some reason, Mesopotamia was full of it, like old Persia, what we know as Iraq today. Maybe because Mesopotamia was so old and so many things have been brewing there for so long. But there would be certain holy sites. It's like in Catholicism over the last couple few centuries where somebody will see some kind of vision and they'll build a shrine there, and then Catholics will travel there and pray there. There's some kind of image in the rock or an image in a tortilla or something. I mean, there have been some of those, okay? Really, I'm not making that up. And people flock to that. It's the same kind of thing. Something's happened here in this location. And think about it. If you're looking for something new, you realize, hey, this is not in my town. I've got to go somewhere else and find it. I've got to go to an exotic place and find it. People love the exotic. People in the East love love things in the West, and people in the West love things in the East. And so there was some local deity. It was not the traditional deity. Everybody knew about Mars, and everybody knew about, you know, Artemis, and everybody knew about Jupiter and Zeus and so forth. This is a guy. Oh, who's this guy? Never heard of this guy. Well, this people here, this small little group of people living in Euphrates River Valley, and they've been worshiping this god for 1,000 years. And you wouldn't believe, they've got the clearest skin and prettiest hair. It'd be something like that, that it would appeal to people. I mean, it's almost like, you know, the Fountain of Youth kind of legend. And they emphasize a personal connection. You're not participating in this as a group, but you personally are seeking this way. And here's a classic example. It's called the god Mithra. And this god was worshipped in the area that we know as Old Persia, that's still sort of called Persia. And think about what, and this was, Mithra was a god of like light and so forth, but basically a sun god connected to the power of the sun. Now think about it. This is like the edge of the Roman Empire, Persia. Who would be going to those far out regions of the Roman Empire in large numbers? Soldiers. Exactly. You already knew this. You cheated.
Well, they had to war with the Parthians.
Okay. This was a favorite god among Roman soldiers. Somehow it just caught on among Roman soldiers. And the tougher, the more disciplined soldier you were, somehow you were attracted to this god. Because this was not a god that allowed you to indulge your flesh. This was a god that called you to self-denial. And we know how disciplined the Roman legions were and the Roman soldiers were. Pound for pound, the Roman soldier was probably the best soldier ever in human history. The Romans didn't have, you know, nuclear missiles and tanks and stuff like that. But pound for pound, the Roman soldier, you'd be hard-pressed to beat the Roman soldier for a fighter. And a lot of that had to do with their reveling in masculinity and their discipline and all those kinds of things. And so this was like the soldier's god. This was the god for tough guys. And there were like elaborate initiations to become a disciple and a worshiper of Mithra. Not just anybody could do it. And there were degrees of advancement. It's almost like getting, you know, your brown belt and your white belt, yellow belt, purple belt, brown belt, black belt kind of thing. You know, it reminds me a lot when you read about it of the Masons. Well, the Masons have these degrees. Masonry's about died off in America, but at one time it was quite prevalent. But you have these degrees and these secret initiations, and it's not easy to be a Mason. You got to go through all this stuff and be tested. Same thing. And that relief right there is a Mithranic narrative that was actually carved near Rome. So the worship of Mithra went all the way from Persia to Rome. Do you see? This goes back to the point I was making to you, Andrew. See how Rome, maybe not the entire Roman state and people, but different people within the Roman state and the empire are pulling all these different religions toward Rome. We'll show you another example of that. So, then there is, this is just the best way to categorize them, what would be called personal religious activity. And watch how this rhymes to 2023, to 20th century and 21st century America. There were oracles, and oracles were believed to be special spokesmen for certain gods. And we've noted how that gods, that the worship of these false gods did not encourage morality. However, everybody wants to get some kind of guidance. People still want that. God, what do I do? Which job do I take? Which city do I move to? You know, what car do I buy? You know, what person do I marry? And so people would go to these oracles. These oracles would emerge, and sometimes they would just claim to be an oracle and they would just catch on. Sometimes they would have like a system to produce an oracle, and then that oracle would die and they'd pick a replacement. The most famous one among the Greeks was the oracle at Delphi. And this is the site there. And look at that location. By the way, Asheville would be a great place for an oracle. You get what I'm saying, right? You go to some picturesque place, and you know there are mountains, and you know clouds are misting over the ridges and so forth. And it's like there's got to be somebody with special insight here. There's just got to be. And so the oracle at Delphi was just, people came from all over to the oracle at Delphi. And so that's one thing people are doing. And it's an aspect of paganism, but it's actually a human giving you guidance for your life. Who you should marry, or what should you take this trip, or should you, you know, enlarge your farm or something like that is what they're looking for. They're not necessarily looking for moral guidance. They're looking for life decision guidance.
Is it like a psychic?
It would be. I'm going to come to a psychic in just a second. You're on the right trail, but we're not there yet. Oracles actually are getting a message from a god and giving it to you, okay? That's divination. We'll get to that in just a second. There were the healing cults. We talked about this, that there was a temple in Corinth where people would come. We talked about this when we studied Corinth. People would come and they would go through therapy, and there were like beds, and they would lay out in sun, and there were like exercise areas because this temple was supposed to be a god that could heal you. Well, there are all kinds of healing cults. And so if you had a certain disease, that's the god you wanted. And so this was about your personal need and so forth. Now, this is more like psychics, Jennifer. And that's what is called divination. You see this in the Old Testament too. This is basically fortune telling. Or like psychic readings. This is somebody who claims to have a supernatural ability. Not so much from a god, like the oracle at Delphi or some oracle some other place. They just believe they were able to tap in to the supernatural and give you insight about the future for a fee. Now, do you understand why Paul would go to a new place in these Greco-Roman communities and he would take funds from another church that knew him and not from the new church that he was planning? Do you understand that now? He didn't want people to think he's just some other fortune teller, oracle, diviner. Okay, so he took money from the Macedonians when he came and worked among the Corinthians because the Macedonians knew him. They trusted him. There was magic, and I don't mean like, you know, card tricks and pulling a quarter from somebody's ear or something like that. I'm talking about people who claim that they can cast a spell, that they can tap into supernatural power, and this was going on in the first century, and people would go to these people. Simon the sorcerer of Samaria would fall into this category. He claimed to be some great power of God. And astrology was pretty big. There were certain emperors that hardly made a move without consulting the experts on the stars. So astrology was pretty big. And certain individuals would go. This is like an individual thing. Just like today. People, you know, pursue their horoscopes personally. They go to psychics and so forth. So your point, Jennifer, about psychics is falling right into this category. Okay. Then there's the cult of the Roman emperor. I just have to throw this in because it's so germane to New Testament events. and post-New Testament events with Christians. When Alexander conquered in the East, oftentimes he was treated as a god. That was a new thing for these people of the West, like the Macedonians and the Greeks. And as the Roman Empire supplanted the Greek Empire, Alexander's holdings, Ptolemies and Seleucids and so forth, as the Roman Empire spread eastward, more and more of the Roman rulers were treated as gods by those in the East. Not so much those in Italy, but those in places like Egypt, Asia Minor, Mesopotamia, so forth. So Octavian, the nephew of Julius Caesar, who wrestles power and becomes the chief, the first consul of Rome, and gets it from Mark Antony and so forth after Julius Caesar's death, who is later on dubbed Augustus, Caesar Augustus. He is the first Roman emperor that in his lifetime, in a small way, is treated as a god. There were temples built in his honor in the East. However, back in Rome, he wouldn't allow that. He pushed the idea he was merely first citizen. Now think about it. Because see, he is the bridge between the Republic and the Empire. He wants to give every appearance of belonging among the people, among the Senate, and being a true Republican in the Roman sense. And so he downplayed that thing in the West. That's bad politics. In the East, they wanted to treat him as a god, and he allowed it. So they built temples to him. It was Augustus also that built a temple in Rome to Julius Caesar for people to go and worship and pray. So he elevated Julius Caesar to a deity after his death. And that's what happens to Augustus after his death. Remember, Augustus is the ruler when Jesus is born and dies a few years after the birth of Jesus. Augustus is officially dubbed a god by the Roman government after his death. And people could pray to him and do homage to him, etc. And so what's happening as the New Testament is unfolding, during the ministry of Jesus, during the days of the apostles, in the Roman Empire, there is a slow march toward emperor worship. Now, this was very common in other cultures at other times, like the Egyptian pharaoh was considered a god back in the Old Testament. But this was sort of a new thing for the Romans. It was usually after their death. Typically, it was after a Roman emperor died, they would deify them. They would have an official act and ceremony, and they would build a temple, and people would go and pray to them, and so forth. It was Caligula in the mid-first century that actually began to encourage people to worship him as a god. But he's a little bit of an anomaly because he's a nut job anyway. So we'll just say that about Caligula. He was just nuts to begin with. It was Domitian in the last century, the last decade of the first century, that in his lifetime promoted himself as a god. Things he wore and things he did. Now he was assassinated. And he was sort of, his name was turned into mud after his death. But he was actually, he was setting a precedent there that, yeah, it's okay to look on me as a god as I'm a living emperor. And this continues to flash up in the second century and into the third century. And this is what creates tension between Christians and the Roman Empire eventually, because Christians resisted this. They would not go because you would have to go in the local temples and pay homage to Caesar once a year. Because that's what a good Roman would do. Because this was being used to tie people to the Roman state. And the Christians said, I cannot call Caesar my Lord. And Lord meant, Kurios meant a god. Now, as a result of that, Christians were looked upon as subversive. Even criminals. However, the persecution was really sporadic in the 2nd century, 3rd century. And it was greatly regional. It just depends on the local rulers, whether they wanted to hammer down on the Christians or not. Sometimes they winked at it, so they didn't go worship the emperor. No big deal. I don't like him myself. Other places, if you didn't go worship the emperor, they would crack down on you. They'd throw you in prison, maybe even have you put to death. That happened in a few places. So, that's the Roman emperor worship. out of time, wish I could talk more. I want you to think about how that, I'm going to jump ahead to this. Philosophers are the ones who provided the morality. We talked about that in the Corinthian class. They're the ones that taught people how to be an ethical standard. That's where people went for that. But I want you to think about the clash between Christ, his gospel, and his followers, and the Greco-Roman religious world. You talking about a contrast. Is that a contrast or what? And that's the clash you begin to see in the book of Acts, and that's the clash that the letters are anticipating. So you guys, I'll be over here with the teenagers by that quarter, Lord willing. Les is going to teach you the book of Colossians. Watch how in the book of Colossians, that clash right there is so apparent. Okay, I'll let Les borrow that slide if he wants to. Okay, thank you very much.